All right, there we go. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to, I almost said Past Summit, that's next week. Welcome to TechEd Europe. This is Introduction to SQL Server Management for the Non-Database Administrator. My name is Danny Cherry. My contact info is up there. Theoretically, it's at the end of the slide deck as well. I've also got business cards up here if anybody wants to grab one from me. There's my email address, my Twitter URL. I am a Microsoft MVP for the SQL Server product. I'm also a Microsoft Certified Master, so I'll be one of your few SQL Server speakers this week who does not wear a blue shirt that says Microsoft on it. So I can answer any questions that you bring up, and in a way that a Microsoft employee may not answer them. So first question, are there any Microsoft employees in the room? No. Excellent. All right, so where are my systems administrators? About a third half of the room. Okay, developers? Okay, about another half. DBAs, one poor schmuck up here, a couple guys in the back. All right. You guys are going to be very bored for the next hour and 15 minutes. I hope you're okay with that. Who's in here waiting for the free beer? Like all of you. Okay. Good news, there is free beer tonight. Bad news, it's not in this room. It's in the exhibit hall next door. And not until after the session ends, thankfully. So don't try and leave right now. So our agenda for today, if my clicker will start working, there we go, is we're going to look at a bunch of various different pieces of the SQL Server product. Let me get these all up on the screen here for you. So these are all the things we're going to cover to some degree over the next hour and 15 minutes. So if you haven't figured it out yet, I like a very interactive session, so feel free to ask questions. One of these lovely ladies is going to be running around with a microphone, or scream your question really, really loud to me so I can hear you, and I'll just repeat it back for everybody else and for the recording. So we're going to talk about files, file groups, and disks, and how those all work in SQL Server. We're going to talk about backups. We're going to talk about recovery models and how those work with your backups. We're going to talk about database maintenance. We're going to see how close I can get to the edge of the stage without falling off. We're going to talk about compression within SQL Server. We're going to talk about corruption inside SQL Server. We're going to talk about compatibility levels, what those are, how they work, what they do, and then we're going to talk about indexes. Big hint, indexes are your go faster button. That's how you make SQL Server work better. So, let's get started. So, files in SQL Server. Every database you have is made up of at least two files. Those files are the master database file and the transaction log file. That master database file, that contains by default all the information that you store inside that database. So anything you write to the database through an insert or an update statement is going to get saved into that data file. And anything that is written is going to be logged into that transaction log file. How much data is kept in that transaction log file solely depends on the recovery model that we set and how often we back things up. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. Inside SQL Server, we have a logical construct called a file group. The reason we have file groups is because sometimes our tables get very, very large. We may have a table that contains 2, 3, 4 gigs of data. That same table may suddenly grow over time to 2, 3, 4, 5 terabytes worth of data. So we need a way to tell SQL Server to write that data for that one object across multiple hard drives. And so how we do that is through this concept of file groups. The file groups each contain a minimum of one file. As your database grows, you can add in additional files to that file group. So the SQL Server will then start writing your data across multiple hard drives. So this is very, very common to see as databases grow, especially if we're using file systems like the MBR file systems, or MBR volumes, because we can't grow them beyond 2 terabytes. So if I've started my database off at 100 gigs and I need to grow it, you know, to four terabytes, and I'm using MBR disks, I've got no way to do that. I've got to at some point add a second hard drive. So I add another drive, I format it, I tell SQL Server, add another file, to this disk, add that file into this file group, make it a member of the file group, and SQL Server will now automatically write the data to both of those hard drives, to whichever one's got free space on it. If one of them fills, it'll simply just use the other one. As you continue to grow, you can just add more and more files into the system. You can have up to 32,000 files in a single SQL Server database. That's not a challenge or a suggestion. It's just the limitation. Obviously, disks hold all these files. As systems administrators, all you see of the database is this big, huge file sitting on the hard drive that probably annoys you to no end that it's just one big file. Maybe we can make it perform better by moving it into several smaller files. It actually won't. It doesn't matter to SQL Server if we've got one large file or a bunch of smaller files for all our normal databases. As long as we've got a file, SQL Server is perfectly happy and it'll access the data on the hard drive just as fast if it's one file or multiple files. Now, if we take those multiple files and spread them out across multiple LUNs on our storage array, for example, now we've got more disk capabilities, so now things may run faster. But that's because we've changed the disks underneath it, not necessarily because SQL Server has access to multiple files in the database. So when we create our tables, we create the table inside of the file group. We tell SQL Server when we create the table, we do create table, we give it a name, we give it a list of columns. And at the end of that create table statement, we say on and we specify the name of the file group. By default, it's going to be a file group called primary. That's the first file group that's always created. Typically, your file groups only need a single file. But again, if your database continues to grow and you go beyond the capabilities of your hard drives, then that's where you're going to want to start getting into multiple files within that same file group. Now, like every good rule in IT, there's an exception to the rule of one file per file group. And that's the TempDB database. The TempDB database only gets one file group. There's no point in adding additional ones to it. It's not going to help you any. Most SQL Server instances, like probably 99.99% of SQL Server instances, will perform best with between 4 to 8 files for the TempDB database. If you're using a lot of temporary tables or you're pivoting very, very large record sets, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of rows, then it makes sense to start adding more of these. The reason it makes sense to add more of these at that point is because you get a very specific kind of lock happening within SQL Server on a very specific page. That page is the page allocation units page. What that page does is it tracks what blocks within those files are used by objects and which ones aren't. So when we have a lot of waiting because we're waiting to write to that lock allocation page, that's because we've got a lot of things happening at SQL Server all at once, so we need to simply give SQL Server more of these lock allocation pages. How we do that is simply by adding files to the TempDB database. So like I said, 99.99% of instances out there should have between 4 to 8 files. Typically, I just tell my clients, throw 8 files on there, and odds are you're going to be fine. I've got exactly one client with one application that has more than 8 files. They have 192. They are the edge case, not the norm. Odds are everybody in here, if you set SQL Server up with 8 files, it'll be perfectly happy. How you do that is fairly straightforward. So here we have Management Studio, everybody's least favorite SQL Server management tool, but unfortunately the only one we get, and that is not my mouse. So if we navigate down here to System Databases, we'll see the TempDB database sitting in there. So we're going to go ahead and modify that and add some more database files to it. The easiest way to do that, right-click properties. You get the properties up. Here you can simply add some more database files. So just click add a few times. You get some new database files. We add them in, tempdev2, tempdev3, tempdev4. Now, I'm not putting these on separate hard drives. I'm putting them on whatever hard drive my current database file's on. Now, we want the database, the TempDB database, on its own hard drive. That's typically going to give us the best performance. All these files can be created in the same physical hard drive because we're not actually going to be reading and writing to these all that much. We're going to spread the workload out across the 4 of them instead of having all the work going to the one file. But putting them on separate drives won't necessarily help performance all that much, again, unless we're putting a lot of separate spindles under each one of these database files. Most people simply put them in on the same drive, for the TempDB. How we size these files is going to be done based on how big the TempDB currently grows to. So if our TempDB database today grows up to 10 gigs in size, what you're going to want to do is set all four of those files to start out at 2.5 gigs in size. That way, when SQL Server starts, it's already allocated out to 10 gigs. We don't have to worry about growing the database files. And SQL Server is just set up and ready to work as efficiently as possible. We don't need to go making any changes to it. You'll also want to change these auto growth settings. The settings that Microsoft provides you by default are not optimal, also known as horrible. So you want to change that growth setting from 1 meg by default to a more reasonable number. I typically tell my clients, set that for 1 gig at a time. If you're on a really high load system, you might want to set it a little bit higher. That way SQL Server is not necessarily growing files all the time. It's growing them in a big enough chunk that it doesn't need to make a whole lot of changes to the, it doesn't need to grow that often, but it grows fast enough that users don't have to wait for it to grow before they can actually commit their transactions. That is not a clicker. That is. So, I talked about recovery models. We have three recovery models available to us in SQL Server. We have simple, we have bulk logged, and we have full. The recovery model simply controls the amount of logging that happens within the SQL Server database. It doesn't stop logging. A lot of people think that simple is going to actually turn logging off, and it's actually not going to do that. What we're mostly doing is controlling the recoverability of the database. We're deciding if we're going to need to recover to a specific point in time, more importantly, to any point in time, or if we're going to be okay simply restoring to our last full or our last differential backup. So the simple recovery model has a minimal amount of logging that it does. Most transactions are still fully logged. What a fully logged transaction is when we write data to the database, we record the transaction ID, the object that we're modifying, the old value, and the new value. All that information gets written to the transaction log every single time we run a command, an insert, an update, or a delete command. There are some commands which we can do that are called minimally logged operations. These are things like index rebuilds, bulk insert operations when you use BCP, or the .NET bulk logged operation, or if you go into SSIS, SQL Server Integration Services, and check that fast load box when you do your destination, those are all doing bulk insert operations. So those operations are minimally logged. So we're not writing every single insert to the transaction log. All we're writing is the fact that an insert happened and that a page was allocated to the table. That's all that has to happen at that point. Because we're not logging all the information to the transaction log, we do not get point-in-time recovery. So we don't get the ability to go, I want to restore the database to October 17th, 2014, 4:21 p.m. and 17.3 seconds. We just simply don't have that option available to us because we're not taking transaction log backups at this point. So like I mentioned, a lot of people think that snapshot recovery model disables logging because it keeps the transaction log from growing. Has anybody seen a database where the database is like a few megs and the transaction log is like gigs or hundreds of gigs in size? Okay. Odds are you probably just need to turn that puppy to snapshot recovery model, wait about 2 minutes, and then you can shrink the transaction log down and you get all your drive space back. So that's a fairly common problem, as you saw by the fact that like half the hands in the room were up. So bulk logged recovery model, some of the commands are bulk logged. Not all of them, but some. So the commands that can be bulk logged are, all other commands are logged through the full logging process. We do get point-in-time recovery with bulk logged recovery model. That's the big difference between here and snapshot. Same amount of logging is happening, but here we do have the point-in-time recovery. If we look at the full recovery model, basically nothing is going to be bulk logged here. every single operation you do is a fully logged operation. And that's because we need that point in time recovery. So we need to have every single command logged fully. So if those of you who had your hands up when I asked about the small database with a huge transaction log, this is how your database is set up today, this full recovery model. That's the default on all new databases when you create them in SQL Server, unless you've made changes to the model database, or unless you've told SQL Server to make changes to that. So full recovery gives us full protection of all our data. We can roll back to any point in time or roll forward to any point in time when we're doing a restore. This is how all of your online line of business applications should be set up, is in the full recovery model. So backups. Backups are the most important thing that you can do with your SQL Server database. Because without backups, you can't restore. So in SQL Server, we have three different kinds of backups available to us. We've got full backups, we've got differential backups, and we've got transaction log backups. So differential backups are very similar to incremental backups in the file system. In incremental backup, the big difference there is the incremental backup in the file system is anything that's changed since the last incremental backup or the last full backup. A differential backup is going to be anything that's changed since the most recent full backup. So there's the key difference. That's why they have different names. A lot of people will think about them the same way, but they are quite different. And I'll talk about the recovery in a second. If you've got a large data warehouse, you may be doing something called file group backups. So this is an advanced backup option that I'm just going to touch on when we get to the recovery part. So basically what you're doing here is you're only backing up pieces of your database. You back up only the pieces that are currently changing. So what you might do in a data warehouse is you might have one file group for each year's worth of data. Once that year's done, you might then mark that file group as read-only. You'll take one final backup of that file group, and you'll never back it up again. All you'll then back up is the new years. This makes your recovery, your backup times much smaller. It makes it a lot easier to recover the database, because you only need to recover whatever part of the database became corrupt. Always make sure your backups are written out to another machine. This is the biggest mistake I see people making when I walk into new clients. I'll walk in, we'll look at the backup strategy. Oh yeah, we back up every single day. We do a full backup daily. We do our transaction log backups all throughout the day. Okay, cool. What hard drive is your database on? Oh, the E drive. Okay, where are you writing your backups? Oh, we're writing them to the E drive. Okay, that's not gonna work. Because when you lose the E drive and you lose your database, what have you also now just lost? All your backups, not very helpful. Always make sure they're at least written out to another LUN, preferably another storage array completely, because we need to make sure we've got a copy of those backups to restore from in the event that something does go wrong with our database. So, when we take a full backup, we're making a point-in-time copy of our database. That point-in-time copy is going to be the same state the database was in when the backup completes, not when it starts. Most people think it's when it starts. It's actually at the end of the backup process. At the minimum, you should be doing those daily or weekly, depending on the size of the database, how long it takes to back up, and how long it takes you to recover, and what your recovery objectives are. This is where we have to go back to the business and ask the business, how long can the system be down for? How much data are we willing to lose? Once they say zero and you tell them how much that's going to cost and they give you a new number, now we can start having the discussion about that. For large systems, personally, I like backing up full backups daily, and then I'll do transaction log backups throughout the day. Some of my clients prefer to do full backups weekly, because they've got such a huge amount of data, they can't get the full backups done within a 24-hour window. I've got one client like that. It takes us 32 hours to do a full backup. So obviously we do those once a week, we do differentials throughout the week. So like I mentioned with the differential backups, these backups are all the changes since the last full backup. Mostly I see this being used for reporting databases. Not too many of my clients are doing differential backups for their line of business applications, with the exception of that one edge case. The reason most of them don't bother doing this is because it's just easier for us to do full backups every day than to do a full backup once a week and then differential backups every day. Differential backups are nice because they reduce our backup window throughout the week because we're only backing up the blocks that have changed. The downside to them being it lengthens our restore process. Because to restore the database, I now have to restore the full backup. I then have to restore the most recent differential backup and then all my transaction log backups that happen after that. So it's all about balancing out how much time it takes to back up versus how much time it's going to take you to restore. Most of my clients are more worried about restore times than backup times, so which is why a lot of them simply aren't using differentials. So the third backup type is the transaction log backups. So this is simply backing up all the transactions in the transaction log since the last backup. All those guys that had their hands up raised earlier, when we talked about the small database with the big log, you've never taken one of these on that system. I can pretty much guarantee it. If you had, the transaction log would probably not be that large. So first question I typically get when I start talking to a client about transaction log backups, how often should we be taking them? That is totally up to the business. As IT, we should not be driving this number, because it's not up to me as to how much data the business is willing to lose. The business has to drive that number. You can take backups as frequently as once a minute. Again, not a recommendation or a suggestion, but it is an option. I usually won't go any more often than every 10 minutes. And the reason for that is because the more often you take these transaction log backups, the more files you're going to have to restore when something goes wrong. So if I'm running my transaction log backups once a minute and my system crashes at 10 p.m., I've now got 22 hours worth of backups that I need to restore. So that is some absolutely ridiculous number, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,320 files that I would need to restore. So assuming that the whole server crashed and had to be rebuilt, I would now need to script out 1,321 restore commands. Obviously, not the easiest thing to do. That's a lot of files that have to be restored. There are ways to automate restores and make these things much easier to deal with, but that's still a lot of stuff that has to be restored. And more importantly, that's a lot of physical files that I have to manage on the file system. So it's a lot easier to do it maybe once every 10 minutes, once every 15 minutes. Because now suddenly there's a much, much smaller number of files to manage. But obviously the business does have to be willing to lose that 12 to 15 minutes worth of data. Most of my clients end up doing backups maybe every 12 or 15 minutes. 12 is usually the sweet spot that I can talk them into. It's not that many files to restore, and it's not that much data to lose for most customers. So actually, before we do that, so how do we actually do backups? So there's a few ways to do backups. I'm going to show you the Microsoft native functionality. There is plenty of third-party functionality out there that you can use to actually get databases backed up. So the easiest way to do it is with this thing down here called maintenance plans. So maintenance plans are not the best thing in the world. They're not the most configurable thing in the world, but they're built into the product. They work fairly well for backups. Don't like using them for index maintenance too much, but they work pretty good for backups. And they'll make it so it's fairly easy for you to actually build a backup and recovery strategy fairly easily. So let's go ahead and build a new maintenance plan. Yeah, sure, we'll call it that. So we get a nice little GUI editor, so we don't have to type any commands, we don't have to know any T-SQL to do this. So this makes it fairly easy. We'll leave the toolbox out, get rid of that. So we've got a subplan. So the first thing I like to do is rename the subplan to full backups. And then I'm going to grab my backup database task up here in the upper left and just drag that in. It's nice and easy. So easy, even a DBA can do it. We open it up, maybe. Oh, no connections. No, there's a connection, local server connection. Properties. Why is it not working? Okay, I've honestly never had a maintenance plan not work first time I opened it. Maybe call it backups. Backup database. There we go. No idea. So, backup type, full. What kind of databases do we want to back up? All databases, system databases, all user databases, or these specific databases? Personally, selecting these specific databases, you're just asking for trouble. Because when you add a new database, you need to remember to go in here and make a change. So I like selecting all databases. And I love this new checkbox at the bottom, ignore databases where the state is not online. What this does is prevents the maintenance plans from failing in the event that I'm in the middle of restoring a database. So if I'm doing a restore, I can't make a backup of it. So it's going to ignore those databases. So click OK. Where do I want to back it up to? I either go disk, tape, or in SQL Server 2014, I can back up to a URL as well. And that URL would be Azure Blob Storage. So in this case, I'm going to back up to disk. I can back up to a destination. I only have one hard drive, so I'll back up to my C drive in this case. If I want to make maintenance of these folders easy, make it easy to find the files I'm looking for, I can check that box, create a subdirectory for each database. So inside this folder, it's going to create a new subfolder for every single database in there. Give it a backup extension. Go into options. I can set any options I want here. Backup set will expire. Keep in mind, this will not tell SQL Server to delete the files. All this does is prevent you from restoring from this file after X number of days. I've never set this in 15 years of being a DBA. I just delete the files. Copy only backup. What this does, if I set copy only backup, is it prevents SQL Server from resetting the differential counters. So if I do a copy only backup and then I take a differential, it's based on the previous full backup before the one I just took. Most of the time, you won't want to set that checkbox. Verify backup integrity. All that does is make sure that the backup headers, or sorry, the tape headers in the backup file are intact. It does not verify that the backup is valid. The only way to verify a backup is valid is to actually restore that backup from back into SQL Server. I've got the option for backup encryption, because again, I'm using SQL Server 2014. If I want to use that, just check the box, specify the algorithm, select the certificate or key that you want to use, click OK, all my backups will now be encrypted. If you're going to encrypt your backups, make sure you have a copy of that certificate somewhere. If you do not have a copy of that certificate stored outside of the database backups, and you lose the server, and you need to restore your backups, you have no way to restore them. There is no way to get into those database backups without having a copy of that certificate handy. So I've now got my full database backup set up. Let's change that subplan name again. I can now go in and add a second subplan for my transaction log backups. Do the exact same thing, drag in the backup database task, change that to transaction log. You'll notice here that system databases is grayed out. That's because log backups or transaction log backups on system databases are not supported. So don't change the system databases from simple to full recovery. So set that for all databases, ignore databases where the state is not online. Basically leave all the other options the same. You'll notice the backup extension is .trn instead of .bak. Doesn't matter what file extension you use. You can use any file extension you want. These are just the defaults, and there are specific icons that show up in Explorer based on these specific file extensions. Again, same options available. Click OK. So we now need to schedule these backups to happen. We schedule these backups based on the subplan. So if we go into the full subplan and we click on that little calendar button, we get a job scheduling window. So here we can tell SQL Server how often we want these backups to run. Daily, weekly, whatever intervals we want. It's a fairly robust, fairly good job scheduler. So we set that for daily. We'll back them up at midnight. And it's midnight on the server's local time, not your local time. So whatever the server thinks the time zone is. It's a big problem in the States. We have lots of time zones. Set a start date. So if we don't want backups to start for another like 5 days, because maybe we're in the middle of restoring databases and we just don't want the extra stuff running, we can tell it to not start until the future. You can tell it an end date if you plan on decommissioning the server, or you can just leave it for no end date. I honestly don't think I've ever set an end date before on a backup job. Click OK. Do the same thing for the transaction log backups. We want them running throughout the day, so we're going to set it for daily. Set it for occurs every, and we're going to change that from hours to minutes. Like I said, I like 12 minutes. It's going to kick off at the top of the hour at 0 minutes past the hour, and every 12 minutes is going to run, so conveniently we're going to get an even number of backups throughout the hour, so we're not going to miss any. Click OK. Save our package. Start SQL Agent. Yes, I want to start it. And if we go into the jobs, we'll now see there are two jobs on the server there over on the left-hand side, backups.full and backups.logbackups. So those are the two jobs we just created, and they're going to kick off on their individual schedules. So you can run full backups and transaction log backups at the same time. There's no problem with doing that. So if your full backups take 3 hours to run, for example, you can still do your log backups throughout that window. This wasn't always the case, but that got fixed back in like SQL Server 2005, so that does work now. So if we wanted to do differential backups, we could just add a new subplan, and we'd be good to go. So restoring data. Obviously, if we're going to take backups, we intend on restoring it at some point. Obviously, knock on, plastic particle board, we don't want to ever actually have to restore our data, but it is something that does unfortunately have to happen time and time again. So how do we restore? What are our options? We can do a full restore, so we can restore our full backups. We can do a differential restore, so we can restore our differentials. We can do our transaction log restores. We can restore from our transaction logs. We also have another option. We can do a page level restore. So a page level restore, this was introduced in SQL Server 2008. And what this lets us do is restore an individual 8K page in our database. So everything that SQL Server does, it does in 8K blocks, 8K pages. This is SQL Server's unit of measure for doing everything on the disk and in memory. So when corruption happens, it happens within an 8K page. Now, if I've got a 1 terabyte database and I've got one 8K page corrupt, do I really want to restore my entire 1 terabyte database just to fix 8K of space? No, that's not exactly efficient. That's going to take me a few hours to do, and that means downtime for the application while that restore is running. So what I can do is I can tell the restore database command to only restore that one 8K page. So when I do find my corruption, it's going to tell me the 8K page that's corrupt, or the several 8K pages that are corrupt, depending. You simply drop those page IDs into the restore command and run it, and it'll restore just that 8K of space. You then roll the transaction logs forward from that last full backup until current, and then bring the database online. So instead of taking hours to run, it'll probably take minutes to run. Much, much smaller outage window for large databases. You can also obviously do file group restores. You can back up file groups, you can restore file groups. And again, this is a more advanced feature, but it does give you the flexibility of restoring just part of your application. So say we had a large system, maybe a huge SAP implementation, for example, and we did one file group per SAP module. So maybe we've got a shipping module, an HR module, a payroll module. So, you know, say we've just got those three modules, so we have three file groups. Well, say the disk, you know, dies that all of these are on, and it's determined that the shipping module is the most important one because we need to be able to ship product to customers. So we can use the file group backup and the file group restore options to restore just that one part of the database, just that one file group, and get the shipping module back up and running. And then the shipping module will then work as long as it's not trying to touch any tables that are in the other two file groups. Now, those first four work in every single edition of SQL Server, Express all the way through Enterprise. File group restores, those work as well in all versions of SQL Server, but they work better in Enterprise Edition because Enterprise Edition is the only one that's going to let you keep a partial database available for the users. So database maintenance. So databases need a little bit of love and a little bit of care. If you don't take care of your databases, they will punish you for it in such ways as poorly performing queries for no reason whatsoever. So how we do our maintenance is by doing one of two operations. We can either do what's called an index rebuild, or we can do what's called an index defrag. So the index rebuild and the index defrag, the net result at the end of these two operations is basically the same thing. So it doesn't matter which one you do, as long as you do one of them. The big difference between these two, or there's a couple of differences, but the big technical difference between these two is when you do an index rebuild, it does something called updating statistics automatically. When you do an index defrag, it does not update the statistics automatically, and you have to run an update statistics command after you do your index defrag. Wow, those colors are awesome. So, an index rebuild. This can be done either online or offline. It depends on what version of SQL Server you're running and what data types you're using. So what I mean by offline is that when you run an index rebuild, and if it's an offline operation, that means your users cannot access data or change data in that table while the operation is running. Once the operation is complete, they can go back into the table and do what they need to do. An online operation, your users can do, they can still access the table while the index rebuild is running. Online index rebuilds, Enterprise Edition feature. Offline index rebuilds are available in every edition of SQL Server. For the data type variance here, if you're using one of the blob data types and you're using SQL Server 2012 or below, and by blob data types, I mean text, end text, image, var binary max, varchar max, or nvarchar max, or XML. If you're using any of those data types in your table and you try to do an online index rebuild, it will fail and tell you that it's not supported because of the data type. In SQL Server 2014, that problem's been fixed. So you can now do online index rebuilds of tables that have those various data types. If you're doing SharePoint, and you need to do online index rebuilds, look at SQL Server 2014. It's full of blob data. What effectively happens when you do an index rebuild is, and this isn't exactly what happens, but it is close enough, basically SQL Server is going to build a new index. It's going to build an exact duplicate of the index. It's going to drop the old one and just slide that new one right into place. Because it's a new index, effectively a new index, you get an updated set of statistics for it. I'll explain all about statistics in a minute. If you do an index defrag, nice thing about index defrags, they're always online. Your users are never blocked from accessing or changing data while an index defrag is happening. That doesn't matter what edition you're in. It doesn't matter what version you're in. This rule applies all the way back to like SQL Server 4.2. The big difference here is that instead of basically building a new index from scratch, we're actually moving data row by row when we're doing this index rebuild operation, or sorry, this index defrag operation. We only are moving the rows that actually need to be moved. So how do you pick between these two operations? If your indexes are heavily fragmented, it is going to be more efficient to do an index rebuild. If they're only slightly fragmented, an index defrag will be the more efficient operation for you to use. So what do I mean by heavily fragmented? Typically, anything over 30% fragmentation, the rebuild becomes the more efficient operation for you to do. Now, how do you write code to do that? There's some dynamic management views in SQL Server that you can look at that will tell you how fragmented each object is that you're dealing with. So you can go look at those dynamic management views. And sys.dm underscore db underscore index underscore physical underscore stats. And then I'll tell you the fragmentation level for every single index and every single database in your system. SQL Server is tracking all that for you in real time. Or, and then you can write some complex logic to figure out what can be rebuilt online and what can't be. Or you can go download a script from a gentleman named Ola Hannegren, and you can install it on your SQL Server. It's just a stored procedure, and it creates a whole bunch of maintenance jobs for you. And it will then do all that logic for you, and you just give it the percentages that you want to use. And it's set up by default for about 30 to 40% as the cutoff point for when you do rebuilds versus reorgs. And his script takes care of figuring out if it's an online or an offline index, and he's got it all set up for SQL Server 2005 all the way up through SQL Server 2014. So you don't have to write any of this code yourself. So, I promised I would bore you to death with what statistics are. So here we go. Statistics are how SQL Server figures out how to access data. So one thing you need to know about SQL Server is when you run a query, doesn't matter how simple or complex, SQL Server needs to figure out how it's going to go get that information, what operations it's going to perform. There's about 30 various operations SQL Server can do to actually go get this data out of the system. How it figures out what it's going to do is by using these statistics. These statistics are used to create what we call an execution plan. We can then look at the execution plan and see what SQL Server is going to do as far as how it's going to get this information. What the statistics are is simply a sampling of the values from within the table. A statistic can contain up to, but no more, than 200 samples from within the table. So it does not have a full set of the data available to it. So it's a very small subset. This is why we need to keep these statistics up to date. If the statistics are not up to date, SQL Server has no idea how to access the information in your table correctly. So Microsoft has a large SAP implementation. They're an SAP shop, like most large companies are. And they were having a problem with their statistics on their SAP database. Because it was so large, as new data was getting inserted for the new calendar year was not showing up in the statistics until August. It took that long for the statistics to get updated, because the update statistics algorithm that runs automatically only kicks in every so often. So they had to put what's called a trace flag, or a special flag in the system that we can activate and make those statistics update more often. So in addition to the values that it samples, those 200 values that it samples, it also counts roughly how many rows there are between those values. This is how it knows how big the table is and how it can make the intelligent decisions it needs to make to try to figure out how to access the data. So here is what a statistic looks like. Now, don't freak out about the date being back in 2012. It's an old screenshot. So we'll look at a few pieces of this before we really dive in. So we can see here we've got the name of the index that this was created on. So statistics are created per index I can also create statistics that are separate from an index as well, depending on what my requirements are for my query. By default, SQL Server is going to create these statistics automatically. You should almost never need to create statistics manually. There's sometimes that you do, but usually you won't need to. You can see when the statistic was last updated. We can see how many rows there are in the table and how many rows were sampled. So in this case, SQL Server did a full table scan when it updated the index, or when it updated the statistic, rather. Sorry. As the tables get larger, SQL Server will only look at smaller and smaller pieces of the table. So this will tell you how much of the table was sampled, how good its estimates, how much of it's estimating. We can see there are 200 steps in the statistic, so it's as big as it's going to get. The average key length is 12 bytes, and that's because it's all numeric data types. We can see if it's a string, and if it was a filtered index or not, it would be marked there, and how many rows there are if it's not filtered. So we can see here the density values for these various columns, and these are all the columns that are created within the statistic. Now, the statistics only contain data for the leftmost column, or in this case, the product ID. The reason for that is because if they contained data for the other columns, they would start getting much larger, and suddenly we'd have huge amounts of data that SQL Server would need to sift through, and creating an execution plan would start taking way too long. So if we look at the actual data from inside the statistic, now I picked this particular statistic on purpose, because it's got this range rows value here. There's a laser. So it's got this range rows value here of 218. So just so we could show that there was, you know, a possibility of getting data in there. So we can see here the range high key. Those are all the values from that product ID column that are within the table. Range rows, how many rows match that value? How many rows there are within the range between that value and the next value. The equality rows, the EQ rows, how many rows match that product ID. How many distinct range rows there are, and then the average range size, or the average range rows. So these are all the values that we can get back. So this is all the information SQL Server uses to try to figure out how to run queries. Again, it doesn't matter how simple the query is, just select star from table, where column equals value, or if it's a huge multi-table join. These statistics are what it uses. So you can look at this information if you need to, if you're curious as to how long it's been since statistics have been updated, by running dbcc show_statistics. And it'll give you this exact output of information for whatever object you specify. If you run dbcc show_statistics and you get an updated date that's way in the past, that tells us that your statistics are out of date. You need to then run update statistics for that object. That'll refresh all this information. SQL Server will generate new execution plans, and your query performance will probably get better. Another way you can see that your statistics are out of date is by looking at the execution plan itself. If the estimated number of rows in the execution plan, and unfortunately I don't have a screenshot for this, if the estimated number of rows in an execution plan and the actual number of rows in an execution plan are way off, then your statistics are out of date, because SQL Server doesn't know how many rows it should expect. And by way off, I mean typically tens of millions of difference. If they're off by like 200, yeah, I don't care. But if they're off by some huge number, like it says one row estimated, 100 million rows returned, your statistics are out of date. Run update statistics, odds are your query will start performing better. Compression. We have compression in SQL Server, introduced back in SQL Server 2008 as both backup compression and database compression. So compression in SQL Server, it saves space within the database, within RAM, within SQL Server, and in our database backups. How much of it you save is going to be totally determined by the data that you have in the system. Now compression obviously costs CPU. We're saving space. It's going to cost us something. It's going to cost us CPU time, CPU speed. It is almost always worth it. If you're low on disk space and you've got lots of CPU to burn, turn on compression for some of your bigger tables in SQL Server, some of your bigger indexes in SQL Server, and you'll save a good chunk of space, and you'll be able to reclaim that space for something else. It'll save you from having to buy storage later. If your CPUs are already running really, really hot, obviously I would not recommend turning on data compression at that point. When we're doing data compression within the database, we've got two options. We can do what's either called page compression, or we can do row compression. These are two different algorithms within the database. Basic rule of thumb, if there's only numbers in the table, you want to use row compression. If there's text in the table, you want to use page compression. Now, if you're using Unicode data, any data type that starts with an N, that only compresses in SQL Server 2012 and above. When this was introduced in 2008, it did not compress Unicode data. Keep in mind, also, if you've got blob data, so again, text, nText, image, varchar max, varbinary max, nvarchar max, XML, those values will not compress if they're over about 8,000 bytes. That's because they do what's called overflow, because they don't fit within our 8,000 byte bound, or 8,060 byte bounds that we have to work with. So the SQL Server does not compress those. Now that said, even if you've got a table that's got a lot of these lob columns in it, a lot of lob data in it, you'll still get a decent amount of compression. One of my clients has a fairly large table. Last I looked, it was about 3.2 billion rows. The table consists of two numbers, a date, and a blob field, which is a fairly large blob field. Table range at about 1.2, 1.3 terabytes for a single table. We turned on compression on that table. We used page compression. And it actually got it down to about 600 gigs. So we were able to save 600 gigs of hard drive space. That's a decent amount of hard drive space to save and a decent amount of money to save. So it was well worth it. They've got plenty of CPU overhead on that system. If you're looking at backup compression is an on or off flag. You either compress the backup or you don't. So backup compression, if you're using SQL Server 2008, the original release of it, that is only an Enterprise Edition feature. In SQL Server 2008 R2, backup compression became a Standard Edition feature. So all of you guys that are running Standard Edition on a lot of your servers, which is most of us, let's be realistic, you've got this as an available option to you to make your backup smaller. That'll cut your backup restore time and make your life better. Now you'll notice at the top there it says that that compressing data in your database saves space in memory. So how does it do that? The reason we can do that is because when we compress the data on the disk, when we cache that data in memory, which is why SQL Server likes lots and lots of RAM, because we're caching data, when we cache that data in memory, that data stays in exactly the same format as it was on the hard drive. So if it's compressed on disk, that means it's compressed in memory as well. If the data is compressed in memory, that means we can fit more rows in memory because the data is compressed. It's smaller. That's the way this thing works. So that can make our application run faster, even though we're putting more workload on our server, because we only decompress the data that's in memory when we go to actually use it. Once we're done using it, we throw away the uncompressed version, and the compressed version still stays in memory. Corruption. This is the most dangerous thing that can happen to a database, is this is how we lose data. All databases can become corrupt. Corruption is almost always going to be a hardware problem. Starting with SQL Server 7, 99.99% of corruption problems are because of a problem with the storage subsystem. Disks, cables, drivers, something. I've had storage vendors look at these numbers and they agree. It is 99.99% of the time the storage is a problem. 0.005% of corruption problems are because of bad RAM, bad DIMM sticks. The other 0.005% of corruption is because of a bug in SQL Server. Now again, knock on plastic, We have not had a bad, well, we have not had a storage corruption bug in SQL Server with one exception since SQL Server 7. In SQL Server 2012, Service Pack 1, there was a corruption bug if you were running online index rebuilds and you were using a specific number of processors, which I don't remember off the top of my head, and there were a couple of other requirements. This is a real edge case, but it could actually cause it corruption data when it was doing index rebuilds. Best of my knowledge, that's the only data corruption bug we've had since SQL Server 7. The reason I exclude SQL Server 6.5 in these numbers is because if you sneezed near a server running SQL Server 6.5, it would probably corrupt the database. It was notorious for corrupting data. Because corruption can happen at any time to any database, we should be checking for corruption regularly. So SQL Server's got some properties we can use to help us check for corruption as quickly as possible, because we want to find corruption as often, as quickly as we can, so that the problems don't stick around, because we need to find the corruption problem so that we can resolve the corruption problem. So if we go over to Management Studio again, and we bring up the properties of a database, we can go down to the Options tab here. And under Recovery, we have this Page Verify option. And it's got three options available to it. None, Checksum, and Torn Page Detection. So none means SQL Server by default is doing no checking for corruption. If you're doing torn page detection, what you're looking for there is that an 8K block, and again, don't forget, everything SQL Server does is in 8K blocks. When that 8K block was written to the disk, only part of it got there. The way torn page detection works is we take our 8K page, every 512 bytes, we write either a 1 or a 0, and we alternate 1s and 0s down the page. When we get to the bottom of the page, obviously we stop. The next time we write that page, we flip which number came first. So if we started with 101010, the next time we write that 8K page, we write 010101. If at any point SQL Server finds those two bits are the same, we see two zeros or two ones next to each other, we have a torn page. Only part of the page got written. We throw an error message to the end user. We throw a message to the error log. Hopefully you get a page or a text message at that point. And we know we now have a problem that needs to be solved. Unfortunately, it only checks for that half a page. If a bit or a byte in the middle of the page is written incorrectly, it's not going to catch that, because it's only looking for that alternating bit stream. That's why we have the checksum option. When we do a checksum, every time the page is written, SQL Server takes a very quick, like MD3 hash of the table, and stores that hash value as part of the page. The next time we read the page, it does the same MD3 hash and compares the values. If they match, the page is not corrupt, we can use it. If it is corrupt, we need to throw it away and throw an error message, because we can't trust that data anymore. I would recommend that all, except for the absolute busiest of systems, be set for checksum page verification. This will give us the most information and the quickest diagnostics that there's something wrong. This is only checking for some of the corruption problems that can happen. It unfortunately is not checking for all of them. So depending on what is corrupt, and we'll get to how to check for the rest of the corruption in a second, depending on what's corrupt, what's not, that's going to tell us how much data is going to be lost when we go to repair everything. We check for corruption by running something called DBCC CheckDB. This is going to examine the entire database, every page, every value, and make sure that nothing is corrupt. This is how we check for corruption. We need to run this fairly regularly, as often as you can get away with, without, you know, causing performance problems. You also repair corruption using the same command, DBCC CheckDB. When you run it and it tells you that there's a corruption problem, once it's done running, it'll tell you the repair level that you need to run. in order to fix the problem. If it tells you the repair level requires using the parameter allow data loss, that means you're going to lose data. It is going to delete rows because the page of the actual base table is corrupt. If it tells you that it does not need to use allow data loss or repair allow data loss, and it only says to use repair or fast repair, that means that a non-clustered index is corrupt. So you've got a couple of options at this point. You can either run DBCC checkDB and repair it using the repair level it provides, if it's a non-clustered index that's corrupt. Or you can just go drop the corrupt index, rebuild it manually, and you can do all that online, so you don't need to take the application offline. Whenever doing a repair with DBCC checkDB, you always have to take the application offline so it can do its repair work. There are some corruption problems that can happen that cannot be repaired. If you have corruption in one of your system tables, one of your system objects, SQL Server cannot repair those problems. The reason it can't repair those problems is because those tables are what make up the structure of your database. So we look at a database as just rows and columns all stored within tables. Well, the definition of those tables is all stored in rows and columns. So if the table that has the definition for your rows and columns becomes corrupt, SQL Server has no way of repairing that without wiping out all of your data. So the repair option is just going to stop, and it's going to throw an error message saying your database is corrupt and that you need to call product support. Your option at that point is restore from backup. Hopefully you have backups. Happens all the time. Go look at forum posts. You will see numerous examples of people who have found corruption problems in their database but have not had any backups taken of the system ever. Those people are now scrambling to try to solve these corruption problems, and there is no way to do it. Corruption is going to happen. How you prepare for it is going to determine how easy it is for you to survive the corruption and how easy it's going to be for you to get that system back online with the least amount of data loss. That's what this is all about, is getting the system back online, because we know the corruption is going to happen. All right, happier topics. Compatibility level. A lot of people think the compatibility level tells us what version of SQL Server we can restore our database to. We can't. It doesn't. What compatibility level does is it tells SQL Server what version of the T-SQL language we're going to support inside of this database. It does not, I repeat, does not affect the version of SQL Server that the database can be restored to. If I take a database from SQL Server 2008 and I attach it to a SQL Server 2012 instance and I leave the compatibility level as SQL Server 2008, I cannot move that database back. It is now a SQL Server 2012 database. I can leave the compatibility level of 2008 and get the syntax support of the 2008 language, but I do not get the function. I cannot move it back to 2008. So SQL Server supports various down-level versions of compatibility level. It never supports higher, obviously. If you're running SQL Server 2014, you support the 2008, 2012, and 2014 compatibility levels. There is no 2008 R2 compatibility level. If you're running SQL Server 2012, it supports the 2005 compatibility level up to 2012. If you're running 2008 R2, it supports SQL Server 6.5 to SQL Server 2008 compatibility levels. So it's a fairly wide range. It's been narrowed down recently. Microsoft is committed to supporting a minimum of 3 versions of the compatibility level in the product moving forward. As they move to shorter release cycles, hopefully they'll widen that number up to more, but they have committed to maintaining at least 3 copies or 3 compatibility levels at all times. So, let's talk about indexes. Indexes are your go faster button. This is, remember the turbo button on like 386 computers? This is SQL Server's turbo button. This is how we make it run faster. So what an index is it's basically like the card catalog. All right, so who's old? Who remembers what card catalogs in the library are? God, that's so depressing. It's like 6 of you. I know half of you are lying. I can tell by your hair color or lack of hair color, one of the two. So what we do with an index is we take our table. So our table is card catalog. So I'll have to give a refresher course in card catalogs for the 85% of you. What the card catalog is anybody remember the library? Let's start with that. Okay, most of you, okay. So you've all been to school at some point, good. So in the library, they've got something that looks like the picture on the screen, full of little index cards that have the name of the book, the author, the publisher, all sorts of useful information. So those are sorted by default in alphabetical order by the title of the book. So that's really handy if you happen to know the title of the book you're looking for. So if I'm looking for my book, Securing SQL Server, third edition coming out probably in January, that's fine. I can go find that book in the card catalog. But if I need to go find all the books that I wrote, I've got to search all of the cards. Not very efficient. So what we need to do is we need to put an index on that. What the index is going to do is it's going to store a duplicate copy of the data, and it's going to sort it by whatever value I tell it to sort by. So in this case, I would tell it to sort by the author's last name. So now I can go search the author card catalog by author name, last name Cherry, find all 7 of the books I've written. I've been a busy boy the last few years. And I can go find all those books and figure out which one I want to look at. And it's very, very quick to look it up that way. If we don't have the author card catalog, I have to scan the entire card catalog. We call that scanning an index. If I have the author card catalog, I want to do what's called seeking an index, because I'm going to go seek right to the exact location I want and pull out the few rows that I'm looking for, or the few cards out of the catalog. This is where we get the concept and the terminology. It hasn't changed since the library. This does cause duplicate data to be stored. We're trading performance for drive space. Drive space, relatively cheap. Employee salaries, which is what time really is we're waiting, employees waiting for stuff to happen. That's expensive, especially if you've got, say, a 1,000-person company, and all 1,000 of your customer service reps are waiting for a query to run for 5 or 10 seconds every time they click the go button, and they're doing that a couple hundred of times a day. We're not wasting a lot of company resources. Spending a little money on hard drives, probably a good plan. When you start building indexes in SQL Server, it's half art, half science. You're going to feel like it's complete voodoo the first couple of times you do it. It gets easier, I promise. So we've got a whole bunch of different kind of indexes that are available to us in SQL Server. We've got clustered indexes. By default, that's going to be the main table, the base table. And we've got non-clustered indexes. If you're going to try to do a little index tuning, a little performance tuning, 99% of what you're going to be doing is going to be non-clustered indexes. We've also got full text, spatial, column store, XML, and semantic search, which was introduced in SQL Server 2012. We're not going into any of those bottom ones. We're just going to talk about non-clustered indexes, since this is what you're going to be doing most of the time. So here's a query that I wrote. I like to use employee tables, because everybody can visualize an employee table. It's got an ID number, you know, last name, first name, job title, department ID, probably a bunch of other columns that HR wants to track about you. So if I want to run the query, select first name, last name from employee, where last name equals Cherry, I need to build an index on the last name column. Because that's how I want SQL Server to sort the data. Because that's what I'm going to go look for the information by. Well, I also want to tell SQL Server, hey, I want to return this first name column. So I want to do what's called include this first name column here. So I tell SQL Server, create an index, give it a name of some sort, doesn't matter what the name is. Personally, I like doing IX underscore and then whatever columns are in it so I can easily see what it's going to be doing. On employee table, open paren, whatever columns I'm going to index by, and you can put as many as 16 columns there, close paren, include, and then whatever columns I need to include. So if you haven't noticed the pattern here, the indexed columns, last name, that's what's in my where clause. The include columns, That's what's in my select statement. Any columns I'm selecting that I'm not filtering by, I want to put in my include column, or in my include statement. So the reason I want to do that is because if I don't have the first name column listed there, when I run my query, I have to go back to my base table to go get the first name value. So this doesn't sound particularly bad, but it actually can get very bad very, very quickly. Keep in mind, everything we do is in those 8K pages. So as we're writing our query, just checking my time here. Okay, good. So as we run our query, we need to go get this information off the disk or out of memory. So it means we need to do IO operations. We need to do IOPS. We assume that everything's in memory. So if we run the query based on the last name, assuming we don't have that include column there, we need to do probably 3 or 4 operations on 8K pages to go find that data. Because we've got to go navigate through the B tree to go find that piece of information. So that gets us back that my last name is Cherry, and it gets me the row ID, or the clustered index value in this case. I then have to go back to my clustered index, back to my base table, use that ID number, and go get the first name value. Well, to do that, I have to navigate the B tree again, of the clustered index this time, do another 3 or 4 operations. I'm now doing 6 operations instead of 3, as an example. For a single row, not that big a deal. But if we're returning a record set with 10,000 rows in it, and I've got 10,000 values that I need to go get additional columns for, so I've done, say, 20 operations to get my 10,000 rows, but now I need to go back to the base table for all 10,000 of those rows. For each one of those 10,000 rows, I've got to do 3 operations. So that's 30,000 operations plus the original, 20. So that's 3,000 operations instead of, 30,000 operations instead of 20 or 25 maybe. That's a really big difference. That's going to be a query that's going to go, instead of running in a couple of milliseconds, that's a query that's going to run in several seconds. So that's a severe performance impact. This functionality has been around since SQL Server 2005. What we can also do is we can do what's called filtered indexes, where we can actually remove rows we don't care about from the index to make them smaller and make them take less drive space. So again, employee table. Odds are when you're running queries in an HR application, in a human resources application, against an employee table, you're almost always going to be looking for active employees. Almost every query is going to say and active equals 1. So what we can do is we can take the exact same index and just do where active equals 1. This now makes the index even smaller, so we don't have all those employees that have left our organization. So for a big company like, say, Microsoft, we've got 100,000 current employees. They've probably got 500,000, 600,000 employees over time. We've now removed 4/5 of the data from our table, so we have to navigate a much smaller subset of information. So, indexes are not free. They cost you drive space, and you've got to create them. They also cost you time on your insert, update, and delete operations. This is because every index I add to a table means I have to maintain the data in that index. So it means I need to insert, update, and delete operations for every single index. So if I've got a table with 10 indexes on it, and I insert a single row into my table, I have to do a minimum of 11 writes to the database. Because I have to write to the base table plus my 10 indexes. The more indexes I have, the more writes I have to do. So it gets very, very expensive very quickly. So because of that, we only want to create indexes where it's actually going to be worthwhile to the application that we're going to get a performance benefit out of it. Indexes that are not being used can simply be removed from the database. There's a dynamic management view we can look at called sys.dm_db_index_usage_stats. That dynamic management view is going to tell us how many times an index has been modified, how many times it's been seeked, scanned, or lookuped against. If your seeks, scans, and lookups are 0, and your updates are some really high number over like 10, well, we'll say 10,000, then you've probably got an index that you're not using, and you can either disable it or delete it. I recommend disabling it, because that way you don't have to remember the definition of the index if you do indeed need that index later, because you can simply turn it back on and let it rebuild. So we have exactly 31 seconds left for questions. Anybody? So if you've got questions, feel free to come on up afterwards. More than happy to talk. Preferably at the booth where there's free beer, but I'll be happy to wait here if anybody wants to chat. I have some homework for you. Sadly, not my dog. That is an adorable picture, though. At this URL, dcac.co/res/teched2014. I've got a bunch of additional reading material for you to look at. If you don't get a picture of the slide, I'll put it back up in 1 second. Keep in mind, there's a whole bunch of additional SQL Server 2014 material that's available to you throughout the entire conference. Also, don't forget to check out Channel 9, look at Microsoft Learning if you want to get certified in SQL Server or any of Microsoft's wonderful products. I'm going to put their marketing hat on for a minute here. Don't forget to check out TechNet or MSDN or Developer Network, whatever it's called these days. Don't forget to complete your eval forms. Here's the bug for it. Hey, look, I was smart. I put it next to the picture of the dog and the URL. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm sorry we're all of 20 seconds over. I appreciate it. I'll see you later this week.